here on KGRA Radio. Welcome to the Richard Dolan Show, where every week we fight the good fight. July 31st, 2017. It's my first time back in a few weeks. Happy to be here. Glad that you are with me. I have a lot to talk about. Don't want to spend too much time chit-chatting beforehand, but I do want to say hello to my producer, Race. Race, how the heck are you?
I'm wonderful, Richard. Glad to hear your voice again.
It's been a little while. I'm trying to remember the last time I did a program with you.
It was before Roswell, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's like over a month ago. What's going on with that?
Yeah, well, you know, you're a busy man, Rich.
I was busy. You were busy, too. It wasn't only me, but
that's true.
Yes,
that's true.
A little bit of travel here and there. I'm very glad that you're back. Your assistant producers were, I'm talking Bill Skywatcher. He was actually very good in your stead.
You know, that's all I get is good reports on him.
Yeah, he's
great. I'm almost thinking that everybody wants to work with him instead of me now.
He's a little bit better than you.
I think he is. I honestly think he is. I really do.
Listen, there's only one the planet. It's you.
Well, personality goes a long way.
It would be KGRA without Mr. Race Hawk. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad we're doing our thing.
Yes, sir.
And one of the reasons I didn't do a program with you is because of, well, what I'm about to talk about now. I was in Las Vegas, what was it, 1 week ago?
Yes, indeed.
For the International MUFON Symposium, my first time back there in a number of years. I won't go into how many, but if you can do the math, it's 2011. So it was 2011. And I was happy to be back. And as anyone who's been following a little bit of the threads of ufology lately, or who has been participating or listening to my program lately, they know some of the issues that were going on, and I want to talk about those issues right now. I wrote a piece for my website and on Facebook a couple of weeks ago on the build-up to the MUFON Symposium, and it had to do, of course, with my participation on the Secret Space panel with the alleged whistleblowers of the Secret Space program. We're talking Corey Good, Andrew Basiago, William Tompkins, and the researcher Michael Sallow, who's not a whistleblower but writes about these individuals, and myself. And that's how it was. And, you know, for many years I've watched, as many people have watched, the claims of alleged whistleblowers, and I am going to use the word alleged, not in a confrontation, but just that's what it is to me. They're alleged. I have watched their claims develop and evolve over the last few years. In the case of Andy, it's been about a decade. Corey Good, not as long. And, you know, I think like a lot of some of the more experienced researchers in this field, some of the more seasoned people in this field, looked upon with a bit of, we might say, bemusement. And if you don't know what that word means, it's always a good Google search. But I looked upon it and thinking, I don't really think this is a good thing, but I'm not really in a position where I want to go out and attack it either. My policy has always been avoid the wars with people, focus on the phenomenon itself. That's fascinating enough. And hopefully, gently, if possible, guide ourselves toward the facts and toward a brave but rational exploration of this subject. So, you know, we're really riding a line here. When we're dealing with the great unknown of the UFO subject, and it is an incredible mystery, there are always going to be things that we just don't know and will very likely never know. We have to realize that we're dealing with a field of great uncertainty. And sometimes when we try to figure things out, we jump into some speculation. I do it all the time. I'm very happy to do it. And the thing is, when I speculate, I like to let you know that I'm speculating. And there's nothing wrong with speculating. In fact, we need to. So we need to know what our facts are. And then we need to exercise our creativity and try to think beyond those facts as long as we realize what we are doing. All right, so in a field of such a great mystery as UFOs, we require a couple of different qualities. It's not simply stick to the facts. It is stick to the facts, but it's also some intellectual creativity so that we can challenge ourselves and to try to understand this subject in a new way. right? And all of these are necessary for us to be able to encounter this incredible subject. So anyway, back to the whistleblowers. I necessarily have a problem with anyone who's a self-described whistleblower. I don't. Just earlier this evening, I had a nice quick email correspondence with Gary McKinnon over in the UK. And I have no problem whatsoever with the claims of Gary McKinnon, none in the least. I am completely convinced he was and is legitimate. And there are many others who have had encounters, inside information, and they've come out with it and they've talked about it. But I've had issues with Andy and Corey and Bill Tompkins, it's true. And they all know this. I'm not telling you anything I haven't said to them. But the whole thing started about 6 or 7 months ago when I was asked by the head of MUFON, Jan Harzan, to appear at this year's symposium. And I thought about it and I said, sure, I will be happy to do it this year. It's been a little while. And he asked me specifically if I would speak on the secret space program. Now, you know, this is something that I have been talking about for a number of years. The first year I believe that I did any kind of public lecture on it was back in 2011, 6 years ago. I've written about this in various parts of my books. It's been a very big interest of mine. And long story short, I have strongly believed for all these years, and I continue to believe, that there is a secret space program, a clandestine element to our presence in space, using probably some very advanced technology. And I've talked about this many times. So, for example, you know, what I've called a breakaway civilization many times, using technology that is classified beyond what we have ordinary access to, being utilized for explicit purposes beyond Earth orbit, fundamentally to deal with the presence of others who are here. That is my particular interpretation of it. Now, I don't pretend that I know this for a fact. It's always been a speculation or a hypothesis. I think it's a pretty good hypothesis, but not perfect. It's not bulletproof either, but it's my working one. And so this is not anything new for me, but I didn't want to talk about the secret space program this year for MUFON. I really did not. I had other interests that I've moved on to within the field of UFOs, and I thought, I don't really want to go back to this. On YouTube already, there are two or three, I think, lectures that you can see of me talking about that subject, and each of them is 90 minutes long, and I mean, why have another? But he pressed me to do it, and I said, all right, I will, and I decided I would do fresh research into this and have new information to the extent that it is possible, and I would do my best, and that was my agreement. So then several months go by, and in my life, it's a daily blizzard of all kinds of crazy things, and I promptly forgot about MUFON for many months until my lovely fiance, Tracy, looked at the website and said, hey, by the way, you may want to know, you're on the panel with Corey, Andrew, and Bill Tompkins and Michael Sala on the Secret Space Program. Thought you might want to know. And I said, oh, really? I went to look at the website, and sure enough. And I thought, I mean, I'm going to just say I felt a little bit like I've been smacked in the back of the head for a minute by MUFON. I thought, you know, I agreed to speak about this. I did not have any idea that MUFON would bring in individuals who I felt had serious credibility questions. So long story short, I had a phone call with Jan Harzan, and in a very nice way said, what were you thinking and why did you do this? And Jan, you know, is nothing if not diplomatic and kind and gracious. He really is. And he said, look, you know, our attitude is we just want to have the people out there and the audience can decide what they think. We just wanted to put all the issues out there. I didn't like that answer, not one bit, but that was his answer. And then I had the option of, do I want to do this or not? Do I want to back out of MUFON or not? I actually did think about it and thought better of it. And then I didn't. And then Jan actually asked me if I wanted to pull out of the panel, and I said, no, do not pull me out of the panel. I want to be on there. And at that moment, I realized that this was going to be something important for me, and maybe for other people following the subject, it might be important for them as well. So I started doing a few interviews. I did one with Race, I can't remember, maybe in May or so. Race might remember. Around that time, we talked about this, and I think that was the first time I did a radio interview about this, and then I did a few others. And they got a little bit of quiet attention. And then I did a much more prominent interview with Bill Ryan, formerly of Project Camelot with Carrie Cassidy, currently with Project Avalon, a very excellent site for all kinds of people who contribute very, very interesting information on not simply UFOs, but everything related to my labs, to secret space program, and everything else you can imagine. The Avalon site is excellent. A lot of smart people contributing there and moderators there. And Bill runs the Avalon site. And about a month ago, I did an interview with him, and that made it to YouTube, and that's got a lot of attention. And I think that really exploded this issue, at least from my perspective, within the field of ufology. And what I talked about with Bill, we had a very good conversation. I highly recommend you go and look for it on YouTube. I think that Bill and I did it right when we did this interview. It was really a conversation. And what we did was we talked in a civil way about these other individuals, but also in a candid way, and describing our various the problems that we had with the veracity of the stories themselves. I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. I'm going to follow up on that theme in a moment. Back to MUFON, I will say this, and I want to say this kindly about MUFON, because I really believe that we need MUFON. MUFON is important. But MUFON also is an organization that, since it was founded in 1969, has always been an organization that really needed to be more than it was. And admittedly, there's always problems with money. There's always problems with just getting enough attention from the public. And in the pre-internet days, it was hard for them to work around this. I can certainly see that. But MUFON has a mission, and that is the investigation of ufology, the investigation, excuse me, of UFOs in a scientific manner for the betterment of humanity. MUFON is one of the really key originators of the phrase scientific ufology. They didn't invent it, but they were really the earliest major promoters of it back in the 70s. Scientific ufology, the idea being we're going to study UFOs, and we're going to do it in as scientific a manner as we possibly can within the constraints available of money and personnel and so forth. I mean, you know, you can't do it perfectly. We'll get it. But MUFON has always had this idea of being a careful, responsible organization when it comes to this subject. So not only does MUFON have a mission statement to that effect, but it has, like any organization, it has a constituency. It has a core constituency. That is its members, those members who have supported it and believed in it for years, for year after year. And for this reason, because of the mission statement and because of the core constituency, I really believe that the decision to include these individuals at the MUFON symposium really has backfired and has been a big mistake by MUFON. And this is with due respect to the individuals themselves, that is to Corey Good and Andrew Basiago and Bill Tompkins, and I'm not trying to malign them personally in this. All right, there are other venues, and they may very well agree with us for all I know, that would be more amenable to what they have to say. And certainly there are people in MUFON who felt exactly that way. And I know because I spoke to many of them last week in Las Vegas when I was there. So it seems to me by bringing these individuals in, the backlash has been severe, as far as I can see. I just read a very extended piece by James Clarkson, former state director of state of Washington and a good guy, great investigator, an important author in this field as well. And he just left MUFON as a result of this and wrote a piece that just said science has left the building. It's not a bad piece at all. And there's others as well. So it surely seems to me that MUFON, by seemingly defying its mission statement, has alienated many of its core members. The organization is going to have to deal with that. They can deal with it. Jan Harzan can deal with it, I believe, but it has to be dealt with. This is a problem. The whistleblower phenomenon, my opinion, with Corey Good and Andrew in particular, and also Bill Tompkins, I do not believe this is going to end well. You mark my words. I don't believe it will end well. I don't know what will happen, but I don't believe it will end well. But ultimately, my opinions on this are not really important. What do I believe and not believe? Do I believe that someone went through a jump room to Mars in the early 1980s with a young Barack Obama, as Andrew Basiago claims? No, I do not believe that claim. And I don't believe that, and I said this to Andy, I don't believe that he went back to Gettysburg in November of 1863 to witness Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Sorry, not believing it. And although I will acknowledge the possibility of a technology that might be able in some way or another to manipulate space and time so that we can jump back 20 years into the past, I guess I'm not going to rule that out completely. However, I have major problems, and I've said this to Corey Good personally, with the idea that a person that he specifically went to Mars for 20 years and then came back, not only age regressed back to his teenage body, but also time regressed so that no one ever knew he left the house. And then he promptly did not remember this until 2014, apparently. So yes, I have difficulty accepting these claims. But again, it doesn't really matter if I believe it or not. My opinion on this is exactly worthless. What does matter, and this is what I said when I was on the panel with these gentlemen last week, and I'm going to say it here. There is an obligation for someone who makes a claim. So for example, when I am speaking about UFOs or writing about UFOs and presenting my message about the reality of that phenomenon to the rest of the world, much of which, of course, is very skeptical about the subject, I am aware that I have an obligation. And that obligation is for me to provide those individuals with as much valid evidence as I can and to provide as much relevant analysis of that evidence as I can for their benefit so that they have an opportunity to examine that evidence. And then by examining that evidence, they have the decision, which is entirely theirs, to accept or reject my evidence. And I can tell you in the years that I've been doing this, I've done my best at providing evidence, and I know that some people have accepted what I've had to say, and others have rejected it, what I've had to say. And that's how it is, and that's the game. You provide evidence. And what I said last week on the panel, and I really would like for this to be available on YouTube at some point. I don't think it is. I'm not sure. I don't think it is. But what I said was, they have the exact same obligation. So if Andy or Corey or Bill Tompkins, for that matter, is going to make a claim that they did some extraordinary thing, they've got to give us something that we can work with. And it's not enough to say, all right, and I hear this all the time. People say, well, you know, it's classified, so we can't expect evidence. I mean, that's just not fair. And so this is what I want to say. On the one hand, I understand that. Of course I understand it. People come to me frequently enough and they come under with the need to be anonymous and confidential. And so sometimes I will get a story from an individual, and I, on occasion, yes, I have repeated their claims to the public, and I have not given up their identity. But that's different, all right? If I'm pressed to the wall to give up their identity, I'll give it up if I had to, you know, if there was a gun to my head, or if they died. I'm happy to do that, all right? That's just what journalists have to do sometimes. But if I'm the person giving you a story of something that I did, and I can't give you a shred of anything to examine, all you're going on is trust me. And that's not fair. So for us to say, well, it's all classified, so we can't expect evidence, I'm going to call BS on that. And especially when it is clearly self-serving, which these stories tend to be. That is a private person whose background cannot even be examined. I mean, all right, it's one thing if the story cannot be examined, but if your own background is impervious to examination of any sort, I'm talking even family members or friends, ways to check up on you. Because after all, if you're going to tell me a story and I have no ability to examine the story, I'm at least going to want to know everything I can know about you. And if you do not give me the opportunity even at least to do that, then we've got a real problem here. So if your background remains a mystery to all of us and you are clearly benefiting from your story, well, you shouldn't be surprised if others of us out there are skeptical of that story. And you shouldn't be surprised if some people really begin to attack you. I will maintain that I'm not one of these people going on the attack. But I will have to say that I feel that I was forced into a situation where I had to say something openly about this. And so I've done that. I don't know how many more times I will do this. I'll probably do a few more interviews about this, and then I imagine I'm going to be done with it and I'll move on, if I'm allowed to move on. But as I said earlier, my hunch is that this is not going to end well for the whistleblowers. I'm already seeing a significant reaction against them. The UFO community, if we can call it that, has become extremely polarized. This is like Trump versus Hillary all over again, except now we're seeing this polarization within the field of UFOs. And I don't think this is going to end well. I think that there's definitely a reaction seems to be taking place. And now it could very well be that within ufology, as in the nation at large, you go into the basic red versus blue dichotomy, and one side just listens to its evidence and the other side only listens to its evidence. And if that's where we head, then that's going to be a great shame. All right. So what I am going to maintain is that a couple of things here. It is not only our obligation in the field of UFOs, for those of us who care, to focus on facts and on evidence, recognizing the complexity of the situation, yes. But I'm also here to encourage everyone listening, if you have any part in this debate, if you have any part of the conversation, please keep it civil. I really mean this. It's very easy to demonize someone else. And literally demonize. I mean, you've got all these people talking about Satanism and you know, Gaia TV, which I am affiliated with. I'm just saying this. This is my own is supposedly satanic, and I'm telling you point blank, I've been to the Gaia location multiple times, and there's absolutely not one single shred of evidence that that is the case. I know lots of the folks working there. They're good people, great people. By the way, my series on false flags is airing, I think it's tomorrow. Geez, you think I should know about this by now. Go to GaiaTV.com. Check it out. I'm encouraging you. And by the way, on my own website, I just today, like an hour ago, got the information on how I can promote this show from my own website. It's not up there yet, but I expect by tomorrow it will be. I see that I'm at the bottom of the hour. I'm going to wrap this up in a minute. I want to emphasize the importance and the capability of all of us to do this the right way. We can, all right? So that is, we can examine the evidence. We can question it. We can reject it. But honestly, let's please try to listen to the other guy, the other side of the argument, and just recognize that those people that we disagree with are still human beings, still doing their best to work their way through this complex thing called life. It's never easy. We're all doing our best. And it's always helpful to remind ourselves that when you trash talk against someone who you don't know, there is a human being there on the other end, and they'll probably read what you wrote. I read all the time, or at least I'm directed all the time to statements that people will say about me, and some of them are very nice and some are very cutting. And I really think that people write certain things not expecting the person that they're writing about to read it. And for myself, I'm going to come back to this theme at the end of the show, by the way, how to stay sane in our crazy world. There is a method of pushing certain things out and creating your own space, and you're going to need it. You need your own space, because I can tell you the entire world, you think it's pressing in on you now? The news that I have for you is that that's never going to stop, and that pressure is only going to increase. So it is up to you to find a method for dealing with it, and I will be talking about that. That's later in the show. When I come back from the break, I want to talk about the Russian hysteria. That is the hysteria in America about Russia. It has gone to a point of insanity. I have a lot to say about that. I've talked about this before. I have more to say. In section three, I'm going to talk a little bit more on the future of censorship, particularly relating as it relates to social media, but a few other things as well. And then at the in the finale, you know, lessons in staying sane. I'm Richard Dolan. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'll be right back after a few minutes of messages. Welcome back. So last summer, I'll direct your memory to June and July of 2016. You may remember there was a big story that came out courtesy of WikiLeaks, and that a bunch of leaked emails of the Democrat National Committee were revealed, thousands of them, showing by any measurement unethical and probably illegal favoritism within the party against Bernie Sanders and in favor of the mainstream, clearly preferred candidate, Hillary Clinton. You know, I had a Bernie sign in front of my house most of the summer. I felt the burn. I thought he talked a pretty good game. And I think like a lot of his supporters and a lot of people who simply thought that they were outside the mainstream, they were a little bit peeved by that and probably not surprised. And incidentally, I just want to mention, I mean, I did have the sign in front of my house, but I am going to say, like, I never really truly felt the burn. I have to be honest with you. I never believed that he was for real. I just thought, well, he's a little bit less crappy maybe than some of the other candidates, including Hillary. And I thought, all right, we'll give him a shot. Never really expected much. But then, of course, you read that the Democratic National Committee and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her pal Hillary Clinton and the other big shots at the DNC actively subverted Bernie, who clearly, I mean, just judging by crowd size and enthusiasm, was vastly more popular than Hillary. I mean, it wasn't even a comparison. And yet he lost several key primaries, and people, there was lots of suspicion over various machinations that were done against him to do that. And sure enough, we find out that the DNC worked seamlessly to work against Bernie. So that was a huge story. And just stop and ask yourself, have you ever encountered such a story in your lifetime in the United States? And I think the answer is no, you have not. I don't remember anything like this. Yes, we know, we all know that political parties, Democrat and Republican, engage in manipulation and shenanigans within their party to get what they want. Yes, we know this. But it never came out so openly, so brazenly, and particularly not in the middle of the election itself. That was astonishing. That's a bombshell. And what happened with that bombshell, with that incredible story? Well, Hillary's team very brilliantly, really brilliantly took the initiative on this, and their response was to deflect, 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 deflect. And they said, Russia did it. Russia did what? I thought you were the guys who were subverting your democracy by torpedoing the most popular candidate. No, no, we didn't do that. Russia did it. They subverted our process by leaking, by hacking our servers and leaking that information to the public to make you think that we're really bad people. And this was the argument, and this was what they said through the summer. I'm glad someone's laughing out there. This is true.
Yeah.
This is exactly what happened.
No matter what was in the email, those don't matter. Just what, you know, what they did first matters.
Forget the actual content of what was being discussed. You know,
nothing to see here. Nothing to see here.
That's right. And then, you know, at that time in the summer, July of 2016, it was the murder of a significant DNC staffer, a man named Seth Rich. It was very significant, completely ignored and is still ignored by the mainstream media. Until now, his murder is consigned to an allegedly debunked conspiracy theory and as fake news. Also brilliant. All right. So I'll come back to Seth Rich in just a moment. So the establishment media, that is the neoconservative and neoliberal media, and that's really what it all is, latched on to the Russia did it meme for several reasons. And really, not just the media, the entire political establishment. A, the establishment media, with the exception of Fox News, were all overt supporters of Hillary Clinton. Not Bernie Sanders, not Trump, only Hillary Clinton. And all you have to do is observe the coverage throughout the entire campaign. So it was politically useful. So that's reason number one, that they latched onto the Russia did it meme. Two, Fox, to some extent, also signed on because as basically a right-wing media group, they also have a stake in bashing Russia. They always have. Three, the military-industrial intelligence complex is very interested in maintaining the Cold War at all costs. All right. You know, I grew up, I was born in the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962. Good God, I just turned 55 last month. How about that? I grew up in the last decades of the Cold War. I remember it very well. I remember the tensions that existed at the time as a kid. Yes, I do. And as I grew up, you have analysts now talking about Cold War II, and they are right to do so. In fact, many of these people are of the opinion that we're in a more dangerous place in the escalations of tension than we were during nearly all of the Cold War during the days of the Soviet Union. And I am also inclined to agree with that, with a very few exceptions of the early period where there were some especially high tensions, Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, Berlin Airlift. But we are approaching those levels of danger. And the military-industrial intelligence community complex loves that. That's where they get their money from. That's where they get their $700 billion a year out of your pockets from, by having an enemy. And Russia is the best enemy of them all. So that's reason number three. So you end up with a story that gets legs that won't quit. The story just keeps going and going and going. Then you get James Clapper, former DCI, head of Central Intelligence, and a proven liar to Congress. All right, he'd lied just not long before. Just before Snowden's revelations, he said, oh, no, there's no evidence at all that the NSA reads personal information of American citizens. Are you kidding me? Obviously, he knew the answer to that, and he just lied. That's what these people do. So you have Clapper now, a proven liar who makes the unsupported statement that Russia interfered with our election by spreading fake news. By the way, if you get a chance, read the report, and I am using air quotes here, that they issued. It was about 25 pages, I think. Half of the report, supposedly proving Russian meddling, focuses on, wait for it, RT News. No, I'm not kidding. I mean, it's that lame. It's that weak. And I mean, who in America even reads RT? I mean, I do, but who else? Not many people. To say that they influence our election. They didn't talk about voting booths. They didn't talk about anything. No claims whatsoever. So that's Clapper. So he's someone who can never be believed anyway, and he gives a report without any evidence. In fact, no evidence to this day. We're just entering August of 2017. This has been going for so long. No evidence has ever been presented that anyone can examine. Doesn't that make you suspicious? Furthermore, WikiLeaks has repeatedly implied, and they imply because they don't reveal their sources, so they do not state these things overtly, okay? But they have made it very clear, we're talking Assange, that the leak, and not a hack, but a leak, came from within the DNC itself, and the implication is that it came from Seth Rich, who, by the way, was a Bernie Sanders supporter, and was very upset over the fact that his own party subverted the candidate of the people, as he saw it, in favor of the corporate candidate, Hillary Clinton. And that is still, I think, the best scenario for how these emails got leaked to begin with, an inside leak from a disgruntled DNC staffer, who, by the way, was one of the few people who had access to all of the key computer technologies of the DNC. Seth Rich was in a position to do exactly what happened. So that is a much more likely scenario than anything else that one can think about. After all, the U.S. intelligence community not only has an imperfect track record on these matters. I mean, it has a nearly uniformly wrong track record when it comes to making claims about other nations and capabilities and motivations. I mean, honestly, they are nearly always wrong. They're nearly always 180 degrees wrong. All right? Do we have to keep beating the drum about Iraq in 2003? Well, I think we need to, because I honestly think people just don't learn lessons. It's been now 14 years since we were lied to repeatedly, systematically, by the George W. Bush administration. By the way, in my forthcoming book on false flags and in my series for Gaia, I break this part down quite a bit. The lies, the systematic, specific lies that were employed to deceive you and to get you to put that yellow ribbon up and support our troops for a disastrous war that destroyed an entire country and really destabilized an entire region. A country that did nothing against us. That's Iraq. They did nothing against us. But you were convinced, because the intelligence community tried to convince you, that they had weapons of mass destruction that they were ready to use against America. Total lie. We know it was a lie. We knew it was a lie at the time that they did it. And it's been proven that they knew it was a lie when they said it. People like Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, George Bush himself. They lied. With the support of the intelligence community. Useful guys, these people in the CIA, those analysts. All right. They got the most monumental issue completely 180 degrees wrong. They did the same thing to Libya in 2011. And this wasn't simply their mistaken intelligence. I mean, it's not that simple. It was falsified intelligence. It was lies. They said in 2011 that Muammar Gaddafi of Libya was carpet bombing his population. I would ask you, if you really care about these things, to go back through the history and look for any evidence, any, that he actually did that. And you will find nothing. You'll find slavishly repeated reports by NBC and ABC and Fox and NPR and all the others from anonymous sources that nothing could be verified. And the anonymous sources themselves were Twitter bots and artificially like created fake accounts, basically. No evidence, not one JPEG, not one video, nothing, nothing. And as a result of that, 2011, this was Obama and Hillary and Mr. Crazy John McCain and the others, they destroyed that nation every bit as badly as they destroyed Iraq, maybe worse. Libya is a crime that honestly will never be expunged from the American history books. It's always going to be a bloody stain, a reprehensible, unconscionable stain. How do you go and destroy the most prosperous, wealthiest nation in Africa and leave it a smoking, heaping wreck for all the rest of all time, which is what they did, bringing in jihadists, organizing them, having them take down a government that had the temerity to defy the Western banks and the United States. And they destroyed that country, a country where women could wear what they want, free housing for the homeless, free health care for men and women. Yeah, Libya had all of that and more local democracy, more, not less, more than what the United States has. Yeah, they had a strong man at the top. That was Gaddafi. But those people lived a good life and the United States destroyed them based on CIA, faulty intelligence, falsified lies is what they were. All right, so back to Russia. Sorry, I get a little worked up. Back to Russia. So we're talking about the United States intelligence community that you are now supposed to believe, again, on Russia. They lied to you about Iraq. They lied to you about Libya. Do you really think they're telling you the truth about Russia? Seriously. And you know, it's not simply the intelligence community. You've got these crazy neocons that are hammering away constantly at the imminent threat that Russia presents and the likelihood of a Russian invasion. I mean, I cannot keep track, almost literally, I cannot keep track of the number of times that we have been told that Russia is about to invade the Baltic states, you know, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia. Pure, total rubbish. Rubbish. Furthermore, it is literally impossible that United States agencies have intelligence on this matter of so-called Russian hacks. It's not simply that they're not going to produce evidence. I mean, they will never produce evidence because it's not there. But the reason that they cannot produce evidence is because they actually don't have intelligence on this. And the reason is because they did not do the investigation. This is something people often don't realize. The investigation, such as it was, which was done on alleged Russian hacking, was done by a private contracting firm hired by the Democratic Party. That company is called CrowdStrike. They did the work. FBI didn't do a thing. CIA didn't do a thing. CrowdStrike did it. They were hired. It is their evidence that the government agencies are going on. I mean, it's astonishing. So literally, like the NSA, CIA, FBI, they don't have the information on any alleged Russian hack because they did not do the investigation. And on top of that, as this whole Russian insanity has continued in this country, then Trump gets elected, right? And immediately we see the destruction of his top guy, Michael Flynn, who was going to be the head of the intelligence community. And why did that happen? I will remind you of something you may have forgotten. One of the last, possibly the last, one of the last executive orders of the outgoing Obama presidency liberated the U.S. intelligence community in ways that are actually astonishing and breathtaking. I mean, aside from saying the obvious word, dangerous. Back in the old days, you may not have known this, you know, the NSA, of course, yes, collects information on everybody. So that's their raw data. But believe it or not, there had always been various restrictions on the other 16 intelligence agencies of the U.S. federal government on accessing that data. Yes, they were able to get that data, but they had to go through certain procedures. It wasn't an automatic. The data couldn't simply be shared willy-nilly with everyone. But Obama's executive order made that exactly the case. So everything the NSA collects now can and is legally being shared with all other intelligence agencies of the United States, including the FBI and the CIA and all the others. They have free, total, complete access. Do you realize how significant that is? As a result of that, this is why Flynn went down as he did. Because what actually happened, he had really a completely innocuous phone call with the Russian ambassador. This is something that Obama's team did back in 08. They didn't get called out on it because Obama was a senator. He was a U.S. government representative, and Trump, as a private citizen, was not. And that was the technicality that they went after. So Flynn has a conversation with the Russian ambassador. It gets the FBI gets it from NSA, and then someone leaked that to the media. That leak was illegal. And the whole thing was clearly done for political purposes to take down Trump's number one guy, the one guy who might have had a chance at reforming the intelligence community, by the way. All right, that's not going to happen now. All of the people on the left who are gleefully watching Trump's destruction, or at least what appears to be his possible destruction, are really missing the point. There was an opportunity, it's gone now, that there could have been a reform of the intelligence community under Flynn, a good reform. Well, that's never, that was a stillborn, so that'll never happen. But this Russian madness continued after Trump's inauguration. The drumbeat continued. And, you know, you could see from time to time all the other mistakes that he was making, the bombing of Syria. I mean, absolutely wrong, unconscionable bombing of Syria while the president of China was visiting, for God's sake. And the escalation of the war in Yemen, which was initiated by the Obama people, and it might be worse now in Yemen. It's certainly not better. All of these are bad things. But you could still see this little glimmer of Trump resisting the demonization against Russia campaign. It would come up every once in a while, and I could see it, and I'm sure you could see it if you were looking for it. But that's all I think that's all over now. Apparently, the Trump White House said just the other day that he intends to sign the recently nearly unanimously passed congressional sanctions bill against Russia, allegedly for its hacking and interference in our election. And as I want to point out, although there's no evidence that Russia did anything to our election, hey, rigging elections, that's our job. That is what the United States does. And that history is long and detailed and inglorious. Russia, there's no evidence that they did it. That's what the U.S. always does. What's astonishing to me, the sanctions bill, it's not just Russia. It includes North Korea and Iran. But it's the real news is that it's against Russia. And in my take on it, this shows Trump's capitulation is now virtually complete. If he signs this, he has capitulated to the craziness, to the insanity. And what the sanctions bill does, incidentally, just to clarify this, it's this is the Congress really taking a control over foreign policy that arguably is not constitutional. Foreign policy is the domain of the U.S. president. Other than the initiative to declare war, the ability to declare war, that's congressional. But everything else in foreign policy is to the office of the president since George Washington. But what Congress has done is they have nearly unanimously passed a measure that will prevent Trump from unilaterally revoking the sanctions, the economic sanctions that Obama placed at the very end of his presidency against Russia. So Trump, if he were politically inclined to do it, if he felt he had the political clout, which he really doesn't anyway, but now he can't because he has to get authorization from Congress if he signs this. And if he vetoes the bill, everyone is saying it's political suicide, and the veto would be overridden anyway. So he's basically handcuffed here. So what we're seeing is this absolute insanity. Oh, and by the way, the whole point of this, the sanctions, it really has to do, I think, with what is known as Nord Stream 2. This is the Russian natural gas pipeline that's going to be feeding Northern Europe. Americans don't like it. The Europeans are very unhappy, by the way, with this sanctions bill. Very unhappy, rightly so, because it's going to handcuff them or hamper them in their own ability to get natural gas from Russia. But consider how insane all of this is. Whose interests are being served by this Russian hysteria? I have been used to, for my entire life, to see the political right have an obsession with Russia. But now it's the political left. I mean, the right, yes, but the left. The left. They are determined to see American relations with Russia go down the tubes. And why? Cui bono? Who benefits? Well, clearly the military-industrial complex benefits, which continues to siphon $700 billion a year out of your pocket. Isn't it time for people to realize that they are being played for suckers? Look, just because you might hate Trump, does this mean you need to play into a lie just because it's politically damaging to him? How far are you willing to go in service of a lie? There will be a day, I don't know when the cards on this matter will be clearly on the table and people will understand just what they've done. And I hope there will be hell to pay for the perpetrators. But I suspect by then, whenever that comes out, that we'll be on to another wholly manufactured crisis that once again works against the interests of the people and of the world. That's the top of the hour. Another hour to go. I'm Richard Dolan here on KGRA. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Richard Dolan, and this is the Richard Dolan Show on KGRA Radio. I'm excited. I've got a program on Gaia TV about to air tomorrow. You'd think I'd know this, the dates better than I do, but it's tomorrow on false flags. And just to let you know, I've got about 200 pages of a book done on this, and I wrote a number of episodes for Gaia on this theme of false flags. A false flag, if you are not familiar with this phrase, I'm guessing most of you listening are, but false flag is simply an act of violence, of treachery, of fear, of something designed to elicit a response that is blamed on another party other than the one that actually did the act. So usually governments and intelligence agencies, we're talking, do false flags. And, famously, Germany did a false flag against Poland in 1939. But since World War II, the king of false flags is the United States. And I have a book coming out on it, and I have a series that is airing anon on Gaia, and I would encourage you to go check it out. And I think there's a lot of good information in there. I'm proud of it. I wrote it. I've hosted it. Production team behind me was outstanding. It's a good-looking show, other than for having yours truly on it. But the graphics are good, so you'll enjoy that part. So let me continue. I want to talk about the future of censorship. Not in terms of mainstream news per se, that's bad enough, but I want to look at social media. Well, Google and Facebook and social media in general. We all know after the November election of 2016, Google and Facebook said that they were going to start banning fake news sites from using their advertising networks. And they said this because they argued that there was misinformation online that became a problem during the presidential election that resulted in the election of Donald Trump. And they were, really quite explicit about this. And this all, of course, plays into what I've just been talking about the last half hour, the whole deceptive storyline that Russia hacked our election. The country got into this crazy hysteria about it. And then we not only get to a point where people are going hysterical about Russia because they're so angry that Trump won the election, but now Google and Facebook have joined in and they've said, well, yeah, we're going to do our part. And in fact, this is what Google said in their statement. I have their quote. They said, moving forward, which is a phrase that I hate, by the way. Moving forward, they say, we will restrict ad serving on pages that misrepresent, misstate, or conceal information about the publisher, the publisher's content, or the primary purpose of the web property. And Facebook basically did the same. They added what they called fake news sites to misleading, disruptive, and illegal sites, which they banned from their network. Now, look, you can say, well, Google is a private company and Facebook is a private company. And you can say, look, they can censor whatever they want to censor. If you don't like them, use a different company. If they want to eliminate thousands of people from their services, hey, they are free to do so. That's capitalism. Get a grip. It's not a right. Google is not a right. Facebook isn't a right. Twitter's not a right. Twitter's not free speech. They're private companies. End of story. That's the argument. Well, I'm going to say not exactly. All right. Aside from the fact that these are private companies that are virtual monopolies in what they do, right? There is a difference there. But more than that, there was a great article in the beginning of 2015 by a writer named Nafiz Ahmed in one of his books. He's a good writer. And his article on the web is How the CIA Made Google. And what Ahmed wrote, and he's good. This is a good piece. He shows that one of the founders of Google, Sergey Brin, virtually reported to the Pentagon and the CIA while developing the project that eventually became Google. Later in the article, Ahmed has quotes people who are close to the CIA and Pentagon as denying a close relationship. So this is a very sensitive topic here. When it comes to Facebook, you've got Zuckerberg, who's funded indirectly by the CIA via a man named Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is a co-founder of PayPal. He was along with Elon Musk. But Thiel was also one of the founders of PayPal. And he invested $500,000 into Facebook. But according to Ahmed, this was actually a CIA investment. I mean, Thiel is very close to the CIA. He has a company called Palantir, worth something, billions of dollars, who knows how many, running secret programs and algorithms for the CIA and other intelligence agencies. And this has been the subject of mainstream articles and journalism. So Thiel later invested $12.7 million in Facebook. So these are companies that owe their existence and their direction to U.S. intelligence agencies. So I don't really see how legitimate it is to say, oh, they're private companies, they can do whatever they want. All right. They have other, you know, demonstrably strong ties that have been shown over the years to the CIA. The CIA famously has been using Facebook, and they probably have something even that, I mean, CIA has inroads into Facebook, and we all know that anything that you put on Facebook is liable to be read by a U.S. intelligence agency. Nothing is safe. They've got it all. So for these organizations to engage in management of news sites, I mean, think about this. The mainstream news has become completely outmatched by social media. Right, so mainstream news or agencies may have millions of listeners, but social media has billions of users, billions. It has completely gone over and beyond the mainstream news. The only thing that's kept the mainstream establishment alive in all of this is that they and the social media are controlled by the same groups, basically the intelligence community and the highest level corporate establishment. They own all of them. And so the social media has turned out to provide an outlet for the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN, the big three of U.S. mainstream news, and BBC over in Britain. So, but what you're seeing now, all right, is it's going even further than what I've mentioned. I mean, yes, we've seen demonetization going on YouTube, which is owned by Google. Sites that are the slightest bit challenging of establishment beliefs get demonetized. Whatever you think of InfoWars and Alex Jones, you can like him, you can hate him. I have always felt that I don't agree with everything that I hear on InfoWars, but I have always been glad that station exists. It is a necessary thing to have an alternate opinion that is out there, even if I don't always agree with them. And sometimes I do agree with them. They've been demonetized on YouTube. So that's just one example of many ways to control and marginalize these organizations and basically turn the internet into 1980s television again, where you had a couple of bland, ridiculous channels of programming, and that was it. There's a guy who I really love reading. I go to his website regularly. It's a man named John Robb, two B's. His website is called Global Gorillas. I love reading this man. I have one of his books. Did a piece about a week or two ago. And I'm looking at some of it here. He's talking about Facebook and Google here, and it points out that Facebook has an initiative now to prevent the creation of fake accounts, and that it's part of a much larger overall effort that Facebook is doing and that Google is doing and that others are doing, which Rob describes as a fully functional global censorship and surveillance system. And I think his point is that, you know, you may have been concerned that this is coming, but it's not speculation anymore. He says it's here. There's a couple of elements of this platform. It's a global censorship and surveillance platform. So we know, that Facebook and Google, well, Facebook definitely has thousands of staffers, over 7,000 staffers, basically low-paid subcontractors, whose job is to read posts and private messages, to find and delete content that they consider to be objectionable. They do this. And then to ban the people who post it. Now, those are human staffers. The real goal that Facebook is working on is to develop artificial intelligence, AIs, that can read posts and messages to identify objectionable content and to do what the human team is already doing, but to do it globally, comprehensively, in a way that, you know, you'd never have enough human readers to be able to manage the system globally, but you sure can have AI agents doing that, AI bots that can do it. Now, the way that Facebook is describing it is they would identify violent imagery and extremist symbols in videos and pictures and rapidly delete them. And they actually can do this. Or, you know, when they're really good at it, they can block the upload or shut down the live stream as soon as it shows up. And it has happened that Facebook was able to delete or kill off a live broadcast of it during a terrorist attack or murders. This has actually happened. They did this. But now they want to replace this with AI bots. I don't know to what extent they're already using this, if they are, but that is absolutely the plan. So you might think, well, that's great. You know, we really want our social media environment to be safe and not filled with crazy people. But of course, you can see where that can easily lead, right? Right. Not simply violent content, but politically objectionable content that goes against the politics of the day, so that you increasingly are seeing less and less true diversity and opposition to the true establishment that will increasingly be targeted. I mean, you can count on it. One of the things that John Robb talks about that they are creating, or maybe already have, is what is called a complete social graph. So what is a social graph? Well, you know what this is, but it's a graph basically connected with the internet that depicts your personal relations with other internet users, right? So it's basically a model or a representation of a social network. So it's like a global mapping of everyone and how they're related to each other, and that's a social graph. And so what Facebook is the ultimate tool for creating a social graph, and you can bet, of course, that the CIA has used Facebook absolutely extensively for this purpose. You know, back in the 1980s, there was a program stolen out of the Department of Justice from one of their subcontractors called PROMIS, P-R-O-M-I-S, Prosecutor Something Management Information System. It was a fascinating system, and it was related to the murder of a journalist named Danny Casolaro. What the PROMIS software did, it was developed at the time, very innocently, to allow prosecutors across state jurisdictions in the U.S. to be able to share data with each other for court cases and whatnot. It was actually an early version of kind of a really good Excel spreadsheet with social networking tossed in there. And I don't really know specifically, but someone within the DOJ saw this and said, wow, this is really awesome. We should use this for all kinds of purposes. The NSA took it and they used it. And then essentially they were able to use it to track people through a kind of early version of a social graph. And that software went around the world, went everywhere to all the intelligence agencies. But now, I mean, we're in a much, much more sophisticated version of that, clearly way beyond. Another thing that John Robb talked about, that the capability either is here or is about to happen, excepting the nations of China and Russia because they're not part of this system, but a real-time census of every living person in the world. So it's a system that knows everything about you, whether or not you're on Facebook or Google. Doesn't matter if you are or not. These companies, in his opinion, are already close to the goal. You got 2 billion users daily, Facebook and every other. So even if you're not on, it's very likely that through your personal contacts who are online, you're part of the network. So where this is going is very interesting and very unsettling. All right. We've got a lot of things going on in the United States and globally. We've got a increasing level of political polarization, increasing levels of economic dislocation, a lot of instability, widespread distrust, which are going to make this whole platform's expansion inevitable. All right. So right now, you got social networks already having replaced the media as the gatekeepers. I was just talking about that earlier. There's no way that NBC News or Fox News or NPR are going to be able to compete with Facebook or Google as a disseminator of information, or YouTube as a disseminator of information. Not even close. So what these companies are going to do is they're going to be using AIs to manage and manipulate information that comes to you. So they'll use that to block objectionable information or to bury it, you know, or to misrepresent it. And they're going to promote the conversations and discussions that they support. It's very simple. They can do this in very subtle ways if they wish. You know, they don't have to be so ham-fisted like a 1930s censor might be. We're in a much more sophisticated age, but managing and management of spin is an art form and a science with these people. So I think we're going to see that. And John Robb makes a very interesting prediction that we may start seeing political candidates from within these companies running for office in many countries having an edge to win on their platforms. Maybe that's why Zuckerberg is people talk about him running. And then a couple of other things to look for. So AI is using real-time – this is Rob here speaking – and detailed social graph information that could become better at detecting violent behavior far sooner and better than human analysts. So that would be a good thing, I suppose, right? Using the social media to protect us from violent behavior. But the real question that you want to ask is, as these capabilities improve and improve and improve, where are the sensors going to stop at intervening in behaviors that they don't approve of? All right? And then finally, what he suggests, and I'll just mention this before I finish up on my own thoughts, is the creation of what he calls a global ID. So basically he's saying Facebook is getting very close to being able to create a global ID for everyone on the planet except for China and Russia. It's not just a piece of paper or something you put in your wallet. He says it will be passive. It will replace your passport and your driver's license. If you can be seen by a camera, you will be known. So, very interesting thoughts. Oh, and by the way, this happened. Here's an article I came across. Tracy sent me this one. Researchers shut down an AI program that invented its own language. I just want to talk about this a little bit. It's very interesting. And this is Facebook related, so it's really relevant to what I was talking about. This came out just on July 21st. This is legitimate website, legitimate story. Basically, an artificial intelligence system that was being developed at Facebook created its own language. It developed a system of code words to make communication more efficient between two AI agents. And that is the word that apparently that is being used to describe the AI bots as agents. Very interesting. Like in The Matrix, Agent Smith. Well, these are AI agents. So when researchers realized what was happening, apparently this is the reason, it was kind of fuzzy on details, they shut down the AI system when they realized that the AI was no longer using English. This is an actual story. I'm looking at it here right now. Essentially, the AI agents that were speaking to each other, one was named Bob and one was named Alice. They were using phrases that appeared at first to be nonsense to the human analysts, but which after they analyzed it, realized, oh, no, this is actually very logical and it makes a lot more sense. These AI agents are being developed to be able to conduct negotiations, essentially to have conversations and develop a kind of back and forth intelligence, something that human beings do every moment of our lives, it's about. So these were two negotiating bots, Bob and Alice, that used their own language to complete an exchange. Bob started by saying, Bob said, I everything else. To which Alice responded, balls have zero to me. And the rest of the conversation was formed from variations of these sentences. And it appeared to be nonsense, but the repetition of phrases like I and to me reflected how the AI operates. And the researchers believe it shows how the two bots working out how many of each item they should take. It's interesting. You could look this up. It's a fascinating article. And the other thing I just want to mention to getting into the whole AI thing. I mean, so in this case, with these bots creating their own language, we're getting to a point where the AI agents are very likely, or at least it is possible, that they will find a way to improve and facilitate their ability to monitor us through social media. We're seeing they develop this little bit of independence, this little bit of new, fresh language, a way to communicate that we were not able initially to follow. And what makes you think that they won't do the same kind of thing once they infest all of Facebook and all of social media? There's another article that I came across quite recent, just from less than a week ago, a few days ago, called DeepMind Creates Imaginative AI That Can Create and Plan. And this is owned by Google. So one story is about Facebook, this one's Google. Google-owned DeepMind has announced an AI agent that is capable of, quote, imagining things and planning how to complete future tasks. The development brings fully autonomous AI a step closer by addressing one of the major shortcomings of current systems, and it goes on. You can read it. So again, we're looking at intelligent AI is – this is no longer science fiction, science fantasy. This is a real thing. This is mainstream news now. And it is being used. It is being programmed by human analysts to control and surveil and censor the virtual world that so many of us live within. I'm talking social media and digital news. So this is a problem. I have some things to say about that in the final segment of this program. And look, I just want to say here, things always seem bad. And the good news, the bad news, is that they've always been bad. It's actually good news because, look, this is not unique. We have unique problems. We always do. Every time has unique problems. But we're not unique in that we have problems. And we're not unique in that we have serious problems. Human beings have always lived with serious problems, and we've always lived with injustice and all kinds of difficulties. So there's no point in despairing. There's no point in just giving up and saying, oh, what's the point? It's easy to get that way. I've had moments in my life when I felt like that myself, but it's not a good idea. Because the thing is, do you really want to live in a utopia? I mean, ask yourself, do you want to live in a world where everything is solved and perfect and there's no challenges for you and there's nothing for you to overcome? Not me. I really don't. I don't think you do either. We do want things to be a little bit better, maybe. That's something we can always strive for. So for that reason, I say despair is not allowed on this program, not here. I always believe in confronting the realities that we face with a cold eye. I always think of that. I don't know where I first heard that, but a cold eye. Don't get worked up. Don't be afraid. Reach down. You'll pull out some courage. You can do it. All right, one more break. I'm Richard Dolan here. I'm going to come back. I'm going to talk about, well, staying sane and avoiding addictions. One of the best television shows I've ever seen in my life was Breaking Bad. If you haven't seen it, well, you've got a treat ahead of you. I guarantee you it's an amazing show. And in one of the later episodes of that show, toward maybe the last season, one of them, there's a really fascinating scene where you're in a corporate, like a production facility of a major snack food company in Europe. And the CEO walks into the room, and he's not having a good day, and I'll just leave it at that. He sits down, and a team of white lab-coated scientists stand in front of him. And there's one guy who's the leader, and they lay in front of the CEO, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 10 different dips, you know, like snack food dips, right? And he's got to taste each one. So these are the creations of these scientists. And the scene goes on from there, and you don't need to know the rest until you see it. But that's real. Like, that happens. So snack foods are the creation of extremely sophisticated science. All right, and it is the science of addiction. And in the case of snack foods, you're really talking about the magical combination of salt and sugar and fat and how they can make them all work together in delicious and perfect and addictive ways to make you want to eat more and to make you ultimately unhealthy, because all of those things are poisons for you, especially the sugars. But it's a multi-billion dollar industry, and it's not going to go away, and they're never going to stop trying to addict you to their foods. Never going to happen. It's one of my weaknesses. I've been pretty good throughout my whole life about avoiding that stuff, but my goodness, if you put me at a party and there's a bowl of potato chips there, you better watch out, because I will fight you for the last chip in that bowl. That's why I don't buy them. That is why I avoid the aisle, and I don't generally have it into my house. Once in a while, oh my God, what? Watch out if they're in front of me. The foods, those types of foods damage our bodies, and they damage our minds as well, because what you eat actually does affect the nutrition that goes not simply to your muscles, but to your brain. So that's one problematic addiction in our society that's not going to go away. Don't expect it. There's too much money behind it. They're going to come after you, and they're going to come after you again and again, and they will never stop. They're like the Terminator. They'll never stop. But that's not the only addictive thing or substance in our world. Far be it. We have a lot of challenges. I was just talking about social media, but I wasn't really talking in the last segment about how this social media empire seeks to addict us every bit as much as the snack food industry. All kinds of technologies that are developing in an addictive way. And, you know, I was just looking at a TED Talk. This, in fact, was directed... I'm really lucky. I've got not just an amazing fiance in every other way, but she gives me really good research stuff. This is Tracy, and she said there's a really new TED Talk. She gets TED Talk feeds. She said, I haven't seen this one, but this looks interesting, and now I can't remember the guy who did it. Very interesting guy. But he was talking about, like, Snapchat. So what I didn't know is that Snapchat has 1 billion users. And there's a thing in Snapchat, and this is really for very young people, there's something called Snap Streaks. I'm sure if you're young, you're laughing at me thinking, oh, yeah, there's this thing called snap streak. But what a snap streak is that it's kind of an addictive thing that Snapchat creates. So like if you Snapchat with someone today and then you Snapchat with them tomorrow, you have a snap streak going and Snapchat tells you your snap streak is up to 2 and then it goes to 3 and then it goes to 4. And what he pointed out is that this is a very clever, very, very smart way to get you to go back to Snapchat, because who wants to break the streak? It's up to 151. Got to keep it going. Facebook also works in addictive ways to keep us back on it. And one thing this guy pointed out was the whole way that outrage works on Facebook. Outrage is really good at getting our attention, and we're much more likely to get onto Facebook if we're mad about something, if we're outraged. And my goodness, there's no shortage of things to outrage us these days. Facebook loves it because it's all about, you know, the point that this guy made is the most valuable commodity to all of these companies is your attention. They must find a way to get and keep your attention for as long as possible. So it's all about maximizing your attention on their platform. And what this is doing, he suggests, is it is changing how we converse with each other, and it's changing our society. He argues it's changing our democracy. He actually, I think he believed that we have a democracy. So I'll have to talk with him about that sometime. But it is changing our society and prompting us into a kind of ongoing series of emotional and personal crises, ongoing feelings of controversy and outrage, since social media feeds on this. And it really does. Like, I have a Twitter feed, and every now and then I'll get onto Twitter, and there's always like some outrage that's going on Twitter. It seems to be the whole point of it when I look at it now. Facebook, very similar. So it's an ongoing cycle of emotional manipulation. It's bad for us. I think you can see that, but it's great for social media platforms that are fighting fiercely for our attention. So you can expect this pattern of manipulation also. Just like the snack foods, you can expect this to exist for the rest of your life. It's never going to go away. Your life, if you let it, will be filled from now on with one crisis after another, after another, after another. It's never going to go away. If you open that door, all that stuff's going to come right in. And, you know, that's social media. There's a lot of other addictions, and I mean, I could just go on and on and on. I'm not really focusing explicitly on addictions, but there are addictions. There's literal medical addictions that we have in this country. I mean, my God, the opioid crisis foisted upon us by a merciless pharmaceutical industry. I just learned, I was just looking into this earlier, more people in the United States die from drug overdoses than have ever died in a single year from car accidents. Car accidents in the U.S. peaked in 1972 at around 55,000. Gun deaths per year in America peaked back in 1993, just under 40,000. HIV deaths peaked in 1995, around 45,000. Last year in America, roughly 60,000 people died from drug overdoses. So more Americans died from drug overdoses than have ever died in a single year from gun violence, HIV, or car accidents. Unbelievably. And by the way, as recently as just 10 years ago, or at least 05, drug overdose deaths were half of what they are today. So this has skyrocketed beyond any kind of recognition. It's just gone crazy. And the primary driver of these overdose deaths are opioid addictions. And you've got basically the drug overlords, which make these things, and doctors, which push them on their patients as a way to relieve pain, painkillers. By the way, the opioid crisis only exists in the United States. It's a little bit of a problem in Australia and is nearly non-existent in the EU. So what every analyst that has talked about this, I've read a few today, all suggest that, well, surprise, profits are the driving force of our widespread addiction. The chief synthetic opioid is called fentanyl. And it's cheap to make, and it gets a lot of profits. And by the way, not everyone's getting them from U.S. doctors. It's easy to get mail order from China on this stuff, so it's very easy to get. So anyway, we have a massive opioid addiction. Incidentally, I read an article at Mercola.com, and I kind of like his site. I kind of like the alternative medical sites, and I sometimes enjoy Dr. Mercola. He talks about ways of dealing with opioid or treating your pain without drugs, I guess is the thing he talks about. And I would recommend, you know, if you're dealing with pain and you're on the verge of being prescribed opioids, I really might think you want to think again. Think long and hard before you do it. Some people do not get addicted to them, but others do, and it can really mess you up. There are ways of dealing with pain that do not have to deal with addictive drugs, but let me move on. We have a fundamentally addictive kind of society. It's the addiction to sex and sexual imagery, and this is for men and women in different ways, but both are for manipulation. Women have it rough. Again, I'm going to refer to Tracy. I had a good conversation with her about this earlier today. You know, she pointed out this is a serious problem. So women are bombarded every day with all of these images of beautiful women coming up in their news feeds everywhere they look. And it's mainly as a form of intimidation of the woman and to get them to buy products to stay beautiful. And particularly women who are, you know, beyond their 30s, who are worried about keeping their looks. They're looking at these products and then they see all of these amazing images, one after the next. Buy this, look great. Buy this, look great. Buy this, look great. At the same time, they're being fed, literally fed, unhealthy foods by the big food industry and the snack food industry that make it impossible to be healthy and impossible to keep one's good looks. Because it makes you overweight and it makes you unhealthy. It gives you bad skin and everything else. So it's a double whammy for women, and it's bad. And men, you know, men are just more manipulated by imagery of beautiful women and beautiful men too. And in many cases for the same reasons. It's for manipulation. It's for either to get someone to look at this beautiful woman to buy a product. Or look at this great-looking guy who's got ripped six-pack abs to be like him and look like him and do whatever. We're very easily manipulated. This stuff is out there because it works on us. And with all of these types of multi-billion-dollar enterprises, that their sole overriding interest, whatever it is they're selling, is to get us to be addicted to what they got. That's fundamentally what it's all about. So for that reason, we really do live in a highly addictive kind of culture that promotes addictive behavior. And on top of that, then in an entire generation, everyone is addicted to cultural norms, especially young people. They're the easiest to manipulate. Addicted to images and, you know, what is it like to be cool? What is it like to fit in and so forth? Very easily manipulated. So what do we do? When I was at the MUFON conference last week in Vegas, a random woman walked up to me. I'd never seen her before. It was a crowded room, and she said, "Richard, what can I do to unplug from the Matrix?" That's exactly what she said. How do I unplug from the Matrix? And it caught me off guard. I remember standing there for a couple of seconds thinking, what is she talking? Like, how do I answer this question? How can this woman unplug from the Matrix? And then I thought about it. I said, well, actually, one good thing you can do right off the bat is find a little gem on your phone called airplane mode. And again, I've probably mentioned Tracy more times in this episode than any other that I've talked about, but Tracy and I, this is something that we've talked about a lot. And I really believe this is important for our mental health. And it's also good for couples and relationships. You go to a certain point of the day, just do yourself a favor and shut it down. Turn your phone off. Go to airplane mode. Now, some people say, well, I can. I've got kids. I've got people who need me. And okay. Well, figure out a way around this. Start blocking people after a certain hour. The chances are you can go to airplane mode anyway. You probably can. All right. I mean, you know, we come to think that everything's an emergency if we're out of touch with the world for like 3 hours. It's the world will go on. No one's going to die. You can go to airplane mode. the virtue of that, the value of that, I've been doing this. We've been doing this for the past, I don't know, number of months. And what we discovered is like, wow, this is actually amazing. It gives you your evenings back. And, you know, in an era where everyone is trying to get into your head to get your attention, and then not just companies, but like your friends. I mean, do you really need a 10:30 p.m. call from a friend who wants to talk about stuff? Do you really need that? Do they need that? The answer is no, you don't. You know, before we changed our world, back in a little decade called the 1980s, I had a very good buddy of mine named Greg, and I needed to talk to him, I thought, and I called his house. He was staying with his parents for a short while. We were about to rent an apartment together, and I wanted to call him and talk about things. And it was like a quarter after nine. And I called his house. There were no cell phones. And I got his father. And I clearly woke the old man up. And he said, yes, well, you know, we wake up early here and we go to bed early here. So I said, I'm very sorry. Back in those days, it was very much not done to call people in their homes late at night. You may be too young to remember this, but that was actually the case. Nowadays, it's not too, like any hour counts, it seems. But it's a bad idea. And I recommend shut your life down, shut the outside world out after a certain time. So that's one thing we can do. Then there's something, I don't really know if this is a phrase, but I'm coining it if it isn't. Slow living. I heard about slow food the other day. There's fast food, right? And then there's slow food. And so what about slow living? So slow food, by the way, is, I think I got this one from Tracy. I should just make her do the show because, like, she's getting all the ideas here. I'm just like her parrot these days. But slow food as opposed to fast food. So the idea of cooking your food slowly and kind of getting into it, you know, like not just rushing through it, but making it a process that's actually meaningful and enjoyable. But I think we can take that idea and into living itself and slow living. I was thinking about this earlier today. Before the program today, I went into my backyard and I sat in a chair with my dog Jenny at my feet. And I don't have the greatest backyard in the world, but you know, it was pretty nice today. I was surrounded by trees. It was very beautiful. It was relaxing. And I was thinking, first of all, we're in a situation where we don't give ourselves nearly enough time alone to reflect about things that are important so that our minds can wander. And the human mind needs to wander. It needs to be able to kind of run free without all of the distractions and all of the clutchy companies and friends and people that want to grab you and take your attention away. We need to have this time so that we can actually play mental games and kind of think about things and come up with ideas. And it doesn't have to be groundbreaking ideas, but just like ideas for you. Things about your life that are important, because you're not going to come up with them if you're not giving yourself time in a quiet place to reflect. And we can't do it like flipping a switch. We need time to get ourselves into a zone. So you can't just sit down and 5 minutes later have your eureka moment. It doesn't work like that. You've got to give yourself quiet, slow time to be able to actually to live your life properly so that you can have proper reflection on the things that you're doing with your life. Otherwise, we're just bouncing around like ping pong balls off in a wind tunnel. Who wants to live a life like that? But yet that's what we're doing. I really believe that the human mind was designed for slow living. We were not designed to live in a constant social media turmoil. Our brains are not optimally designed for that, and that's why we get stress from all of that, and we do. And yes, I know that there are people who live for social media, they get enjoyment out of it, and it's fun for them. Okay, I'm going to suggest, though, if you're one of those people, you might have something lacking in something other part of your life, and maybe that's cool. Like if something is lacking, sometimes social media relieves that loneliness and that boredom. But you should consider that that is because there are other symptoms that may exist in your life. And if social media relieves that symptom or hide or masks those symptoms, okay, I guess that's fine. But it might be a good idea instead to ask yourself, why am I addicted to social media or addicted to some other kind of behavior? It doesn't have to be social media. It could be anything. And the last thing I want to say about this, the way to regain our sanity, because we only regain our sanity by regaining control over our lives. And how do we regain control over our lives? Well, one thing is we do it by doing the things we want to do, and we don't know what we want to do until we sit down and decide what is it that we want to do. So that means you sit down and you make plans. You think, what is it that I want to be doing over the next year? What do I want to have accomplished a year from now or 5 years from now? Think about long-term goals that are worthy goals for you. This is the act of – this is what true creativity in life is about. It's you deciding what is it that you are going to do with your life. You sit down and you think about it. And to the extent that's possible, you map it out. If you want to have a certain degree or a certain accomplishment a year from now, then you think, okay, well, how exactly do I do it? You got to think this stuff through concretely. You can't just say, I'm going to manifest this. Sorry, that doesn't work. Okay, no one just manifests things out of thin air. It doesn't happen like that. You want to know how it really happens? You plan it out and you make it happen step by step. That's how you manifest it. All right, the universe isn't going to give you squat if you don't put in the effort. You got to plan it and you got to do it. And then, yes, the universe will allow you to do it because basically you've done it yourself. So this is why people don't get things done, by the way. Because first of all, if they're on social media, they're de facto not getting anything done, because social media is designed for you not to accomplish a single thing except read passively what other people are doing, and you get into Facebook wars and posts, and all of that is meaningless and is no productivity whatsoever, and it all goes away and it'll all be forgotten by history. None of it will remain. So what you do instead of that is you plan your activities, your accomplishments, your goals. You sit quietly by yourself and you ask yourself, what do I want to accomplish? Because again, when you're on social media, you're not getting things done. You're not producing whatever it is you mean to produce in your life. It doesn't have to be writing books. It doesn't have to be anything earth shaking. It could be anything, but it's the point is that it's yours. It's your project. It's your imprint on this world, and hopefully something to make this world a little bit of a better place than when you came into it. That would be nice. But at the very least, it's something that will make you better than you were before you started it. It'll make you, hopefully, more interesting and more in control and happier and saner, because, again, it's only by completing meaningful tasks in our life that we actually get true value and true meaning in what we do. All right? There was that great novel from years ago called The Unbearable Lightness of Being. It was made into a kind of a boring movie, but the book was great, by a guy named Milan Kundera. And he talks about these different people, these young adults who were living a really kind of nice, easy life, idyllic. They were having relationships without really deep meaning and commitment, and they were doing all of these things, and they wanted a lightness of being, that sense of not feeling responsible for having to do this and having to do that. But the title of the book is The Unbearable Lightness of Being, so you can kind of get the idea. What the main character discovered is that life isn't valuable unless I'm working at something, unless I'm carrying a burden. It doesn't sound fun, but it's what gives us meaning. And it will give you meaning by mapping out your destiny. And that's the word I'm using for you. You and everyone else listening, you've got a destiny. Your job is to find it and fulfill it. You can do it. And that's how you maintain your sanity. You've got to learn to push at a certain part of the day. You've got to push things away. And you have to have time for yourself. I think it was Emerson, one of my favorite writers of all time. He said something like, well, I've read enough books by other authors. Now it's time to do my own writing and my own thinking. And it's a good attitude. I mean, it's not that you shouldn't read other people, but at a certain point, it's time for you to stop being a receptacle for the outside world, particularly in our age now, because it is so utterly toxic and so utterly trying to addict you to everything.
It's time to
instead,
be,
it's time push to be, it out.
It's
was
time
that
to,
race?
It's time to be the pitcher and not the glass.
I like that. How about that? Absolutely. Pour your wisdom out of yourself instead of taking everyone else's. That's a good analogy, Race. So there's no easy way out of the insanity of our world. I mean, it's probably impossible. Well, never say never, but it's difficult. It's a challenge. But it's something that we can all work on every day. We can make a commitment to clear out a space, a quiet space in our life for the people that we love, the people who are meaningful to us. Because ultimately, you know what? Addiction to culture, addiction to social media, addiction to anything is never, ever going to satisfy us the way that true, meaningful, loving relationships will that we have with other people who are important to us and, just as importantly, maybe more importantly, with the inner spirit that is within all of us that drives us, because that's what you're born with and that's what you die with. No matter what else you do in your life, that's what's going to be with you. So take care of that inner spirit. Take care of that inner self. Cultivate it, nurture it, give it the space it needs to become what it's destined to be. So with that, I think it's time to say goodnight. I want to thank my producer, Race Hobbs. I want to thank those very good people in the chat room and thanking you on the other end of the connection. I'm Richard Dolan. Look forward to the next time with you. Now stay tuned for 3 hours of Fade to Black featuring Jimmy Church. And remember, while we learn and grow and search for the truth in all matters, be kind to each other. Good night.